Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests so you can develop your own more informed opinion. My guest today is the Honorable David M. Walker. He is the former Comptroller General of the United States and CEO of the United States Government Accountability Office under Presidents William Jefferson Clinton and George W. Bush. Mr. Walker most recently served as a distinguished visiting professor of economics at the United States Naval Academy. He's here to discuss the economic impact of what has transpired in our country and what is being contemplated on the Hill. Dave, thank you for joining me on Deconstructed.
Good to be back, TJ.
The last time you were on, we were talking about your latest book, whose title posed the question, America in 2040, Still a Superpower? I was hoping the new administration would provide a little clarity, but many of our economic crises still exist. I'm reminded of the first time we met. It was after you did a keynote at an AICPA conference in LA back in 2012. I still remember the warning you shared about our nation's debt trajectory. You featured the national debt clock to reinforce the importance of the velocity at which we were incurring debt. Since that time, it's only accelerated. So we've had four successive administrations whose attitudes can best be described as borrow and spend, or tax and spend, or some blend of both. And once again, we're bumping our heads on another debt ceiling, which technically expired on July 31st. Help us understand what the consequences are of the debt ceiling and why it's a critical issue that deserves far more discussion than it's receiving.
Well, the debt ceiling basically limits the amount that the federal government can borrow. And to the extent that the federal government is not running a deficit, it's no big deal, because basically the debt ceiling limit would be headed at a level that it wouldn't be a problem. But to the extent that the federal government is running deficits and therefore accumulating debt, then it can become a problem. And the debt ceiling limit was suspended as part of the comprehensive tax legislation that occurred during the Trump administration, but that suspension expired at the end of July. So in theory, what's being done is whatever the debt level was on July 31st, 2021, is the ceiling, and therefore you can't go beyond that. Now, obviously, we're running deficits, but there are some things that the Treasury Department can do in order to avoid being able to borrow extra money. Like, for example, if it's running a surplus in Social Security, which is not the case now, or if it's taking contributions in for civilian and military pensions and retiree health care, can hold on to those. It can delay paying contractors. So there's a number of things that it can do to try to keep that from happening. It's estimated that those mechanisms are going to run out in October, and therefore something needs to be done with the debt ceiling limit. There are several options. One option is to continue to suspend it, which I don't think is a good idea, because basically that's running a blank check, especially in light of some of the legislative proposals that are on the Hill right now. Another one is to increase it to a specified number. And I think a decent strategy might be to increase it enough for what the deficit is expected to be for this year and next year, get us through the midterm elections, but not go further than that. And also to try to be able to constrain dramatic attempts to increase the size and scope of the federal government in between now and then. Truth is, TJ, we're the only major country that has a debt ceiling limit. It's stupid. It doesn't work. It hasn't constrained spending. It hasn't constrained debt. And what we really ought to do at some point in time is to get rid of the debt ceiling limit and replace it with a debt to GDP limit that has consequences if you violate it, because there's no way we ever want to default on U.S. debt. And by the way, TJ, there are only two financial things guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution: U.S. debt and accumulated interest, and Union Civil War pensions. And I think we finished paying the latter.
Excellent point, Dave. You know, you and I are both proponents of the debt to GDP ratio. Can you give the audience a perspective of how that has changed over the year and where it stands today?
For a vast majority of the history of the United States since 1789, up until World War II, total debt held by the public as a percentage of the economy never exceeded 35 to 40%. And that's a very reasoned and reasonable level, no problem whatsoever. However, in World War II, It went up to about 106% of the economy, but for a good reason. We were betting the ranch. We saved the free world. We avoided attack on the continental United States, and we defeated the Axis powers. Therefore, we were all in to make sure that we accomplished those objectives. But after World War II, we restored fiscal responsibility. We took steps to grow the economy, and the debt as the percentage of the economy plummeted from about 106% down to 35 to 40%, again, back in the reasonable range in 1980. Then we started losing control again. We regained control during the late 80s, early 90s. And since 2003, we've been totally out of control. So now we're in a situation where debt held by the public is at or slightly above the all-time record at the end of World War II. But unlike the end of World War II, where we were reducing debt to GDP, we are now increasing debt to GDP. And there are those in Congress now that want to take steps that would make it even worse.
I'm going to share a few quotes with you and then look for a comment. Senator Minority Leader McConnell says Republicans won't raise the debt ceiling because of the Democrats, quote, free-for-all for taxes and spending, unquote. Senator Majority Leader Schumer calls those comments, quote, shameless, cynical, and totally political, unquote. So trick question, Dave, whose position is more absurd?
They're both ridiculous. Okay? In truth, I think the right strategy would be, what do we need to increase the debt ceiling limit to get past the midterm elections based upon what the situation was at July 31st, and not considering any new deficit spending that people are proposing to do now. So in other words, some of the need to increase the debt ceiling limit is because of legislation that's already enacted into law. And it's ridiculous to say that you're not going to increase the debt ceiling for legislation that's already part of current law. On the other hand, it's reasonable to say, look, we're already in a deep hole. We got to figure out how we're going to start climbing out. And the last thing that we need and want to do is to increase mandatory spending and make that hole a lot deeper. And so I think the reasoned and reasonable compromise is to increase it by what's necessary to cover projected deficits through the midterm elections that existed as of July 31st, 2021, but not a dime more.
Dare I ask what you feel about unfunded liabilities?
Well, you know, everybody talks about the debt clock, right? And you can look at it online. But, you know, that's basically a down payment on what our problem is, okay? And I'm talking about when we used to have real down payments, like 20%+ of the amount that you bought, not as it is today. The current debt subject to the debt ceiling limit, which, by the way, is not just debt held by the public, but debt held by the Social Security, Medicare trust funds, and other trust funds, is about $28.5 trillion, okay? But if you look at the financial statements that were audited as of the end of September 2020, when you add up total liabilities and unfunded promises, including for Social Security, Medicare, civilian and military pensions, retiree health care, the number was $104 trillion. And that was before COVID. And that number is growing much faster than the economy. So think about this, $104 trillion. That's $315,000 per person. That's $727,000 per federal income tax filer, but it's $1.3 million for every federal income tax payer. And what's median household income? Well, in 2020, it was $67,500. So it's basically 20 times median household income. That's the real hole and why we need to start getting control of our finances.
Now, as I look at those types of statistics and you start realizing that we have interest vulnerability, the interest rates now is fictitiously suppressed. We've got about $3.95, I think it is, trillion dollars in interest. Our foreign debt, China holds about a third of the foreign debt. What type of vulnerability does that present as a country if we were to increase 0.5% to 1%?
Well, I mean, think about it. I mean, let's say the debt is $33 trillion, okay? What's 1% of $30 trillion? It's real money. And so we're in a situation right now that debt to GDP is at or near an all-time record, but interest as a percentage of the budget is not. But the reason it's not is because we're not living in the real world right now. The Federal Reserve is artificially holding down interest rates. The Federal Reserve is buying almost all the new debt that's being issued. So as a result of those two things, the interest as a percentage of the budget, not a problem, but it gives us significant interest rate vulnerability because most of the new debt that we're issuing now is shorter term debt. People aren't wanting to buy 30-year bonds. We don't sell 50-year bonds because they know that you can't continue this policy indefinitely. And what's happened is the Federal Reserve, in my view, has become politicized and is not as independent as it should be because its policies are enabling irresponsible fiscal policy. And it's fueling the modern monetary theorists, which is a downright dangerous theory, which we can talk about if you want in the next segment.
And that's exactly what we'll do. So, Dave, we're going to take a quick break and talk about some of the pending bills and modern monetary theory when we come back. Welcome back. Our guest is the Honorable David M. Walker, former Comptroller General of the United States from 1998 to 2008, and most recently, an individual who served as a distinguished visiting professor of economics at the United States Naval Academy. Dave, when we were finishing up the last segment, we touched upon modern monetary theory. I had Larry Kotlikoff, a mutual friend of ours, on a few months ago, and when I asked him what he thought of it, he said he didn't call it modern monetary theory. He called it ancient stupidity theory. I was wondering if you concur in Larry's opinion or you have a different way to frame modern monetary theory.
Well, first, let's talk about what modern monetary theory is, because many of your listeners may not know. I mean, it's basically a new and unproven theory that asserts that deficits and debt don't matter as long as you can borrow in your own reserve currency, unless and until you have an inflation problem. Well, there's only a few problems with that theory. Number one, it's contrary to history. Number two, it's contrary to long established economic principles. Number three, it's based upon a flawed comparison to Japan. And number four, guess what? We're starting to have excess inflation. All right. And that's before the decisions about what to do with this $3.5 trillion, some people say it's really more like $5.1 trillion proposed expansion of government as part of the budget reconciliation bill. So I think it's downright dangerous. And personally, I don't believe that money grows on trees.
If it does, I want to plant one in my backyard, but we'll leave that for a later discussion. When you brought up the spending bills, we have an infrastructure bill at about $1.2 trillion. We have a $3.5 trillion spending bill. Let's touch upon the infrastructure bill. What are the positives and the negatives of that bill from your perspective?
Well, we're talking at a high level, okay? We don't want to get into the details, but basically, the United States has a serious infrastructure problem. It's got a serious infrastructure problem with regard to its roads, with regard to its bridges, with regard to its airports, with regard to its seaports, with regard to its inland waterways, with regard to its floodwater efforts. There's no question. And we've gone from being a leading nation to being about number 30 in the world in the status for infrastructure. And we've gotten a D grade from the Professional Society of Engineers that looks at this thing every year. And so there's no question that we need to do something. And if we design it and implement it properly, it can be stimulative. It can stimulate jobs. It can stimulate economic growth. All right. And it can benefit multiple generations. And so therefore, it's something that we need to seriously consider. It's also something that is supported by about 2/3 of the Senate, by the president, and it should be fully paid for. It's not fully paid for now. It should be fully paid for, but it is meritorious. There's no question. So that's that bill. There's supposed to be a vote on that bill on the 27th of September. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, promised the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is a group of Republican and Democratic members of the House, supported by No Labels, which I'm a national co-founder of, promised that there would be a vote by the 27th, promised that she would do everything she can to make sure that it passed, but she has not delivered on that promise. One, obviously, it's not the 27th. She's got a chance to be able to make sure that that happens, but she has not been whipping votes on this bill. So that's critically important. So hopefully she'll start doing that. Hopefully she'll deliver on her promise because this can pass the Senate. But that's the first bill. $1.2 trillion. But you have to understand it really is not that expensive because part of this relates to things that were already planned to be spent on anyway. So the excess is about $900 billion over 10 years, but it's needed. The key is, do we properly implement it?
So is it time on infrastructure to get those shovels ready again?
Well, you know, it's not just a matter of the shovels ready. You got to have the permitting, right? And that's one of the challenges that you have with infrastructure is that you have permitting that has to be done. You've got environmental studies that have to be done. And so there's many, many different things. You know, we need to do a much better job of planning and intergovernmental coordination of these types of things in order to have a more immediate impact. Europe does a much better job on this than we do here in the United States, and we ought to learn from them.
Now let's talk about the $3.5 trillion spending bill that appears to be being merged as far as coming to the floor for a vote. What are your impressions of that? What are the pros and the cons of the spending bill?
First, it's not traditional infrastructure. They want to call it human infrastructure because it includes things like child care assistance, elder care assistance, housing assistance, if you will. But it also includes a lot of things dealing with climate. The bottom line is it's not traditional infrastructure. It would significantly expand the size of the federal government indefinitely. It would increase mandatory spending, which if anything, we ought to be reducing mandatory spending, not increasing mandatory spending. It would increase the number of people that are dependent on the federal government. It would decrease the size of the private sector as a percentage of the U.S. economy. And while they assert that they want to pay for it, they're far short of that based upon the proposals that are out there. And here's another key point, TJ. You know, there used to be that people said, well, you know, we'll pay for any expansions of government or any tax cuts. We'll make sure that they're paid for. In reality, they weren't paid for, but that's what the assertion was. Candidly, given the deep hole that we're in, given where we are on debt to GDP, that concept is no longer acceptable. You can't just pay for new things because, as we talked about before in this segment, we're in a $104 trillion hole that is growing faster than the economy. You can't just pay for the new stuff that you're asking for. You got to start figuring out how you're going to fill that hole. So therefore, while I support the bipartisan infrastructure bill, but believe it ought to be paid for, I strongly oppose the much bigger bill for the reasons I've articulated. At the same point in time, there are some elements of that bill, you know, dealing with child care and education that deserve serious consideration. But what's happening now is I think the Democrats, and again, I'm a registered independent, so this is not a partisan thing. The Democrats are very fearful they're going to lose control of the House and possibly the Senate in 2022. The progressives are the energy in the Democratic Party right now. So they're trying to push everything they can as fast as they can in case they do lose control.
There are even elements to that point in the spending bill, the $3.5 trillion one, that impact minority parties. They actually start making it more difficult to qualify under FEC rules and so forth for minority status. So in effect, it almost becomes a defunding of minority parties, which will make it even more difficult for there to be an option to the Democrats or the Republicans. So there are a lot of interesting things that are buried in there. One of the things that struck me when you're talking about mandatory spending, the Medicare provision, they want to lower the age at this point in time, and yet we're having a difficult time even funding Medicare or Social Security. Any quick comment on that before we take a break?
Yeah, Medicare Part A, Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, is supposed to run down to zero by 2026. The Medicare hole is tens of trillions of dollars, and they want to expand Medicare? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It reminds me of 2003, when Medicare was expanded to include prescription drugs. It added $8 trillion in new unfunded obligations on a present value dollar basis. All the numbers I'm talking about with regard to 104 are present value dollar. When Medicare was already underfunded, $19 trillion. It just shows you how out of control things are. You know, everybody wants something as long as somebody else pays for it. But sooner or later, you run out of other people's money.
Well, Dave, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about the economic position of the United States when we come back. Welcome back. Our guest is the Honorable David M. Walker, the former Comptroller General of the United States and CEO of the GAO in the Clinton and Bush 43 administrations. And most recently, Mr. Walker served as a distinguished visiting professor of economics at the United States Naval Academy. Dave, let's move towards something that's on everybody's mind, the forefront of everybody's mind, the pandemic. What do you think the appropriate next steps are, from an economic standpoint at least, with regard to the pandemic?
Well, I think we need to do everything that we can to encourage people to get the initial doses. I personally have gotten the initial doses. There are pros and cons, but you know, given my age, even though I'm in great health, I decided that it was worth to do it. I'm going to think very seriously about whether or not I'm going to get a booster, though, because it's becoming more and more evident that if you're in good health, and fortunately my wife and I are, that you may not need a booster shot. You know, my biggest frustration with regard to the pandemic is the mixed messaging and the fact that we're not getting a consistent message, that people in government are saying they're following the science when in reality they're not necessarily following the science. It's more of a political agenda. When you look at how we're doing things versus other countries, there are significant differences. Europe's got kids in classrooms and they're not wearing masks. And so it's a very confused situation. This was the issue that Biden was doing the best on until recently. And now he's underwater, meaning below 50% on the pandemic. You know, we need to take it seriously, but we also have to recognize that there's got to be some benefit for people who do take the vaccines. If you're going to treat them the same way as people who don't take the vaccines, in other words, restrict their movement, require them to wear masks, and do all these kinds of things, then you're providing a significant disincentive for people to get the vaccine. The other thing you got to keep in mind, the numbers that are being quoted are totally bogus. There are a lot of people that reported as having COVID that never had COVID. And one of the reasons that they're reporting as having COVID is because healthcare providers get paid significantly more money if they say it's a COVID case or if somebody dies of COVID. And so on one hand, you got a lot more people that they've said have COVID that don't have COVID and people who died from COVID who didn't die from COVID, they died from something else. On the other hand, there's a lot of people who've had COVID that aren't in the statistics because they never exhibited any symptoms, they never had a test or whatever else. And so as a result, while it's tragic how many people we've lost, okay, we haven't lost nearly as many as they say we've lost, and the death rate is a lot lower than they're saying. And so I think we need to continue to take prudent steps, encourage people to get the vaccine, but we need to have an incentive for people to get that vaccine and make sure that they're treated differently from the ones that don't. And now you're seeing the private sector take over. For example, I'm going on a cruise. I've got to have a test 72 hours before I go to the dock. I get a test when I'm at the dock. I have to have both of my shots for the vaccine before I even get a test. And when I get off in Bermuda, I think I'm going to get another test. So I'm willing to do that because I want to take advantage of that. But that's something that I get to make the choice. Do I want to go on this cruise and be subjected to all of that, or do I not? And that's an incentive and an accountability-based approach.
Let's move to an entirely different issue. Let's talk about Afghanistan. Back in 2003, we created a special inspector general for Afghanistan reconstruction. What did you learn, or should the administrations that have proceeded since that point in time have learned about our function in, unfortunately, a war and nation building in Afghanistan? What are the positives and negatives that we learned? What have we ignored?
Well, first, I was chairman of the Intergovernmental Audit Forum, which is a mechanism that encourages best practices, education, training, knowledge sharing between federal, state, and local auditors, and the inspectors generals are part of that. Inspector generals actually report to an executive branch agency head and the Congress, whereas the GAO, which I headed, reports solely to the Congress. And so that's the difference. You know, on Afghanistan, look, we had a legitimate reason to go into Afghanistan in 2001. They were harboring al-Qaeda. Our objective should have been very clear: to A, deal with al-Qaeda, who were responsible for the 2001 attacks on 9/11, and to make sure that there was not a government in Afghanistan that was harboring terrorists. We dealt with that. At the latest, we should have gotten out of Afghanistan when we got Osama bin Laden. So we should have been a long time ago. Now, let me define what I mean by getting out. Getting out means drawing down to a very small footprint. It doesn't mean total withdrawal. It means maintaining control of Bagram Air Base with a small contingent so that we can do intelligence gathering and so that we can protect our interest in that part of the world. But we added a nation-building objective. We tried to convert Afghanistan into a Western democracy. This is another example how people who don't read history are doomed to repeat it. The only major battle that Alexander the Great lost was in Afghanistan. The Brits got kicked out of Afghanistan. The Russians got kicked out of Afghanistan. And now the Americans have gotten kicked out of Afghanistan. So we had a legitimate reason of going in. We stayed in too long. We didn't have the right objectives. We did a terrible job of pulling out. Priority one should be pull out all of your citizens and those that you want to get out. Priority two is pull out your excess equipment or make sure it's neutralized. And priority three is pulling out the military. We didn't handle that right at all. And now it's turned out that in addition to losing 13 service members and a number of other people being killed, that the strike that was ordered in retaliation killed 10 people, all of which were civilians, several of whom were children. And I'm still waiting for the accountability for this. I think there should be several resignations from this. And candidly, we've now heard about General Milley's dealings with China, conversations with China. And I think he clearly is one of the ones that ought to resign. At a minimum, General Milley ought to resign, if not more.
One of the things I noticed is that we seem to make the same mistake over and over again, as you alluded to, not learning from history. We tended to think that we could pour more money into it and we would resolve Afghanistan faster. Didn't the cash actually just swell the corruption?
Oh, yeah. By the way, we left pallets of cash behind, you know, and let's talk about another recent example, Iraq. Our son fought in Iraq. He was a Marine Corps captain, fought in Iraq. Went in over the first wave, midnight at the berms from Kuwait into Iraq on the offensive. We never should have gone into Iraq. We went into Iraq under false pretenses. They had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda at all. Saddam Hussein was a very bad guy, but there are a lot of bad people in the world. But Saddam Hussein was also a check and balance against Iran, and now that check and balance has been eliminated, and we've lost a lot of lives, a lot of treasure. And by the way, this was also something that I think Dick Cheney said it was going to pay for itself. I don't think it paid for itself in any way, shape, or form.
Well, Dave, in the limited amount of time we have left, where can our listeners go to learn more about you and your economic insights?
Well, I have a website which has a lot of material that I've accumulated when I was Comptroller General and running a couple of nonprofits. It's called deficitranger.com. I'm on Facebook. I think it's DavidWalker7. I'm on LinkedIn, but I'm involved in a number of organizations that are worthwhile, including No Labels, which is nolabels.org. So those would be a few things that I would say that might be of interest to people.
David Walker, former Comptroller General of the United States, CEO of the United States Government Accountability Office, and most recently, a distinguished professor of economics at the United States Naval Academy. As always, this has been a pleasure. I really appreciate your candor and your insight into our nation's economic challenges and your willingness to offer pragmatic, apolitical solutions. So, Dave, once again, thank you for joining me on Deconstructed.
Always a pleasure, TJ. Thanks for the opportunity.